Law and Grace, Chapter 5. Let them make me a sanctuary. The tabernacle and its object lessons. A habitation of God. The command to build the tabernacle came at a significant moment. The ratification of the covenant had only just been completed when Moses was instructed to order the collection from the people of freewill offerings of materials. Of these, Moses was told, "Let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." The words were simple, but their meaning was profound. A visible material structure fashioned out of their own contributions and by some of their own members, specially endowed by God with the necessary wisdom and skill, was to be made according to a divine pattern to be a habitation of God in their midst. Nothing was to be left to chance or to a human sense of fitness, but everything was to be as ordered of God. According to all that I show thee, after the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so shall ye make it. This emphatic instruction struck the keynote at the outset and was repeated at significant intervals thereafter to stress the fundamental lesson that God alone would determine the conditions of approach to him. When his wishes had been observed in the construction of the sanctuary, then alone would he condescend to dwell within it as proof of his presence among the nation and of his special choice of them. As the work of their own hands, made from their contributions in materials, the completed structure was clearly intended to serve as an objective representation of themselves. How significant in the light of this was the fact that it was made expressly that he might make it his abode. God had revealed his intentions in advance to Moses while the nation was still in Egypt. "I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God." The Exodus and recent covenant ratification were proof of the fulfillment of the first part of the promise, "I will take you to me for a people." Now, his dwelling in the finished sanctuary was to be proof of the fulfillment of the second, "And I will be to you a God." Those intentions were here repeated. "And I will dwell among the children of Israel, and will be their God, and they shall know that I am the Lord their God, that brought them forth out of the land of Egypt, that I may dwell among them. I am the Lord." This showed clearly that their redemption from Egypt had not been a gratuitous assertion of omnipotence on the part of God, but a gracious act with a holy purpose, in the realization of which Israel were now invited to cooperate. God's occupation of a sanctuary made by their hands, and so, on the now familiar principle of representation typifying them, was to be a constant reminder to them of the goal of their national existence. They were so to live as his people that men would be obliged to acknowledge that God was in the midst of them, and come to regard them as a manifestation to the world of God, most holy. Moses had in fact already declared as much in his song, "The Lord is become my salvation, he is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation." A pledge all the more significant because the people sang this with him. This meant, for each individual Israelite, he being the nation in miniature, that he was intended to realize in his own life and experience the spiritual truths of which the sanctuary was but a material parable, that God might dwell in him. That was what he was to see to be the purpose for which he had been saved from Egypt and brought into the covenant. The simple words, "Let them make me a sanctuary," were thus a moral demand as well as a literal order. The sanctuary and the camp. To convey its great fundamental lessons effectively, the sanctuary had of necessity to stand in the closest relationship to the entire nation. This was effected first, as we have seen, by its being fashioned from their contributions, but secondly by its location in the centre of the camp. There had already been in use a sacred tent, where, pending the building of the sanctuary, God had held converse with Moses and met with those who sought him. Appropriately enough, this tent of meeting, as Moses called it, was pitched without the camp, afar off from the camp. Not so the sanctuary, that, unlike the other, was to be set in the midst of the camp and serve as its focal centre, now that by covenant Israel had formally become God's people. With the sanctuary standing in such close relationship to the people it followed, as an essential element in the symbolism, that the camp should be holy. To teach this, use was made once again of a carnal ordinance. As the flesh-eating laws served to remind Israel what was clean typified those in covenant relationship to God, conversely, what was unclean represented those not so related to him. On this account, the contraction of ceremonial uncleanness by an Israelite entailed the technical loss of covenant status. Those affected by it had therefore no logical right to be in the camp. To demonstrate that fact is true in every case, upon the erection of the sanctuary, certain cases, that is the worst, were selected as a ground for formal exclusion from the camp, and the remaining cases as a ground of exclusion from the sanctuary itself. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, "Command the children of Israel that they put out of the camp every leper, and everyone that hath an issue, and whosoever is defiled by the dead. Upon their cure, or after a due lapse of time, as necessity required, a people thus excluded from the camp were permitted to recover their legal status, and with it their right to dwell in the camp, by the observance of highly significant ritual and sacrificial ordinances. While unclean, they were forbidden to remain in proximity to the sanctuary, Both male and female shall ye put out, without the camp shall ye put them, that they defile not their camps, in the midst whereof I dwell. This was of a piece with the exclusion from the soldiers' encampment of any man not clean by reason of uncleanness. He shall not come within the camp, was the inflexible rule in his case, where considerations of hardship could be left out of account. Thus God insisted, through the medium of symbol, that he could not dwell except with those who were in covenant relationship to him, and who realized the implications of that relationship in terms of holiness. God would have them know that he would tolerate no sort of corruption in those who were his. In the case of the soldiers' encampment, it was human excrement which visibly symbolized corruption, and in the case of the camp, it was disease and death. But the rule for the one held good for the other. The Lord thy God walketh in the midst of thy camp. Therefore shall thy camp be holy. Service to God. The innermost tents of the Israelites did not encroach upon the sanctuary. If in imagination we move from the outer confines of the camp toward the center, we find that the same essential lesson was constantly reiterated by the symbolism, and that in successively more emphatic forms. We will now examine these. The innermost tents of the Israelites did not encroach upon the sanctuary. God was too holy, and Israel too sinful, for such familiarity of intercourse between the two to be possible. Girdling the sanctuary were the tents of the Levites, God's specially appointed near neighbours. Physical contact with the structure of the sanctuary was restricted to them as a tribe, and to emphasize that holiness was the prerequisite of approach to God. The washing of their clothes and flesh, together with shaving and solemn consecration by atoning sacrifice, had first to be undergone by them before they could abide near the sanctuary and minister in its court. They were then fit to do the service of the children of Israel in the tabernacle of the congregation, and to make an atonement for the children of Israel, that there be no plague among the children of Israel when the children of Israel come nigh unto the sanctuary. The location of the Levitical tents, separating the Israelite from his God, reminded him of his sinfulness, and the way it excluded him from God's presence. Yet it also presented him with an ideal for the conduct of his spiritual life. For were not the Levites but another objective representation of himself? They were the firstborn in another form. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Bring the tribe of Levi near, and present them before Aaron the priest, that they may minister unto him. And they shall keep his charge, and the charge of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of the congregation, to do the service of the tabernacle. And I, behold, I have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel, instead of all the firstborn that openeth the matrix among the children of Israel. Therefore the Levites shall be mine, because all the firstborn are mine. The Levites appear to have come to occupy this representative position in stages. They distinguished themselves by their zeal for God when the nation had fallen to worshipping the golden calf. Probably it was in recognition of this that it was duly decreed, "The Levites shall pitch round about the tabernacle of testimony." The exchange of them for the consecrated firstborn would follow naturally from this as a more practical arrangement of the working of the tabernacle services, and also as of more striking symbolical value in the scheme of the law as a whole. Everything in connection with their consecration stresses their representative character. "Thou shalt bring the Levites before the tabernacle of the congregation, and thou shalt gather the whole assembly of the children of Israel together, and thou shalt bring the Levites before the Lord. And the children of Israel shall put their hands upon the Levites, and Aaron shall offer the Levites before the Lord for an offering of the children of Israel, that they may execute the service of the Lord. I have taken the Levites for all the firstborn of the children of Israel." As then the consecration of the firstborn taught the Israelites that the whole of his life and possessions were really God's, so the tents of the Levites were an object lesson to him. Of the Levites, preeminently, it was true to say that the sanctuary was in the midst of them, but precisely because of that, the ministry of the sanctuary, that is, the work of the Lord, was to occupy the whole of their working day and the full extent of their active working lives. "For they are wholly given unto me from among the children of Israel, instead of such as open every womb, even instead of the firstborn of all the children of Israel, have I taken them unto me." The children of Israel, in the very act of laying their hands on the Levites during the consecration service, had confessed it to be their duty to devote themselves with the same completeness to the service of God. They were to attain by sinlessness to the reality of which the washing and shaving of the Levites were but dim representations. Thus, as we move inwards through the camp to the sanctuary at its centre, we find the symbolism to be laying increasingly stringent emphasis upon the duty as well as upon the sinfulness of the ordinary Israelite. We find the same to be true as we seek to enter the sanctuary itself. The ordinary Levites did not pitch their tents directly before the entrance to the sanctuary. That position of honour was reserved for Aaron and his sons, together with Moses. Those that encamp before the tabernacle toward the east, even before the tabernacle of the congregation eastward, shall be Moses and Aaron and his sons, keeping the charge of the children of Israel. To stress that any presumptuous approach would have its condign punishment, it was added, "And the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death." The ominous caution brought home forcibly to the Israelite that he could not approach the sanctuary, that is, have access to God, except through the mediation of a priesthood on account of his sinfulness. Yet, once again, the symbolism presented him with reality and with an ideal at one and the same time. For had not God said, "Ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation"? To be a dynasty of priests, every one of them. That was Israel's ideal destiny. But to be that, there had also to be an holy nation. To show them how imperative that was the object of the symbolism of the priestly laws. The Levite, for all his privileges, could not exceed his mandate, except upon pain of death. "They shall keep thy charge," said God of them to Aaron, "and the charge of all the tabernacle. Only they shall not come nigh the vessels of the sanctuary and the altar, that neither they nor ye also die." The priesthood, in the strict sense, belonged exclusively to the family of Aaron, as the rebellion of Korah made decisively plain. "Therefore thou and thy sons with thee shall keep your priest's office for everything of the altar and within the veil, and ye shall serve. I have given your priest's office unto you as a service of gift. And the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death." In keeping with this more privileged position, the sons of Aaron wore special garments, coats, girdles, bonnets, breeches, all of linen, and underwent a far more complicated and significant ceremony of initiation than the mass of the Levites. This was even truer of Aaron, their father. He wore special high priestly robes besides the coat, girdle, and breeches worn by his sons. Where they wore only a bonnet, he wore a mitre or turban. Oil was used to anoint his sons' heads, but not with the same profusion as in his case. Moreover, the demand for holiness assumed its most intense form in his case, for laced to his turban was a plate, a holy crown, and deeply engraved upon it the words, "Holiness to the Lord." Thus, the symbolism culminated in one man, symbol after symbol, each more concentrated than the one before. First the camp, next the Levites, then the priests, finally Aaron himself, represented Israel as they were meant to be, a holy nation. Aaron figuratively bore the entire nation upon his shoulders in the two onyx stones, and upon his heart in the breastplate of judgment, and so stood for the nation as a whole. It was for that reason that he and the congregation were equated in the schedule of sin offering. In his crown, the whole of Israel, on this principle of representation, made a vow that its fundamental duty was holiness to the Lord. Aaron was thus, as the crowned priest, the microcosm of the people, viewed as a dynasty of priests and a holy nation. It was only their representative recognition in his crown of their duty to be holy as God's priestly people that made their offerings acceptable and the forgiveness possible of those sins with which they daily outraged his holiness. "It shall be upon Aaron's forehead," said God. That is, holiness was to be the entire nation's pursuit and the preoccupation of its thinking. "It shall be upon Aaron's forehead that Aaron may bear the iniquity of the holy things which the children of Israel shall hallow in all their holy gifts. And it shall be always upon his forehead that they may be accepted before the Lord." Approach to God. The series of symbols which we have just examined, the camp, the Levites, the priests, the high priest, has what we might call a quality of convergence. That is, while each symbol in the series equally represents the entire nation and communicates the same basic lesson, namely that permission to approach God is contingent upon holiness, we find, as we proceed from one to the other, that the number of persons involved diminishes from a multitude to one. And this basic lesson is presented with proportionately greater force and urgency. The whole series, like a set of concentric circles, one nation, one tribe, one family, one individual. So it proves to be also in the case of closely related symbols, as we shall now go on to see. From a seeming welter of diversified and apparently disconnected symbols, we shall find emerging a theme study of great force and beauty, for by a whole series of devices the law emphasized in the priestly legislation that nearness to God was a matter of the greatest privilege, that the closer man gets to him, the more conscious of the need for holiness he becomes. We will quickly review some of these devices. The Levites, it is clear, were in every way inferior in rank to the priests, and they in turn inferior to their father. This structure of the priestly hierarchy was carefully regulated in the legislation. The Levites drew their sustenance mainly from the tithes of the people, but of these they had to pay the best tenth as tribute to Aaron their head, to be used by him and his family. They could then eat their tithes wherever they chose, and with no obligation to be ceremonially clean when doing so, no penalty was incurred if they were not free from uncleanness. Not so in the case of the priests. If the food to be consumed was of the class most holy, they had to eat it in the court of the sanctuary itself. If it was of the class holy, they had to eat it in a clean place with none but their own families, each of the eaters being under the strictest obligation to be ceremonially clean. In both cases, the legislation served to stress that priestly fellowship with God demanded the fullest conformity with covenant status. No special regulations, again, restricted the extent to which a bereaved Levite could contract defilement by death. In the case of the priests, limited grounds of defilement were allowed, but to demonstrate that the priestly status of the people was incompatible with corruption of any kind, in the case of the high priest, no grounds whatever were allowed. The laws regulating priestly marriages had the same didactic intention. Nowhere is the rational basis of the idiom of the law more obvious than in this complex legislation, for despite its complexity, the symbolism throughout plays variations on one simple theme, that holiness is the prerequisite of approach to God. The higher a man's theocratic rank, the higher were his privileges, and the correspondingly more stringent were his responsibilities. The Levites could minister only in the court, and the priest could proceed no further than the veil, which divided the tabernacle into two, the holy place and the most holy place beyond. The supreme privilege of access into the most holy place, that is, symbolically into the very presence of God, was reserved for the high priest, their father. This ascending scale of values was reflected in the entrances to each of these three spheres of operation. Of the peculiarities of these entrances, we will select one only at this stage. The hanging forming the gate of the court was suspended on silver hooks attached to brass pillars set in brass sockets. The hanging for the door of the holy place was suspended on gold hooks attached to gold-covered pillars of acacia wood set in brass sockets. The veil, barring access to the most holy place, was likewise suspended on gold hooks and attached like the latter to gold-covered pillars of acacia wood, but these were set in silver sockets. Here again, the nearer approach was effected to God, the higher the value of the metals involved, beginning with silver hooks, brass pillars, brass sockets, then gold hooks, gold pillars, brass sockets, finally gold hooks, gold pillars, silver sockets. Always the principle was the same in the law. Approach Godward was reflected in an ascending scale of values. Conversely, at the basis of the laws of uncleanness was the same idea in reverse. Removal away from God reflected a descending scale of corruption, ranging from some uncleanness which lasted only till even, down to such uncleanness as the living death of leprosy. In the priestly legislation in particular, concerned as it was exclusively with approach to God, at every stage the symbolism assumed a pyramid pattern, with the high priest always at the apex. This again had two effects. It emphasized, firstly, how great was the gulf which separated Aaron from the layman, that is, God from man. Yet, at the same time, it intended the ordinary Israelite to see in Aaron the image of his own ideal self. It bade him acknowledge the aim and object of his membership of the priestly nation, to approach to the very presence of God. As it did this, it brought home to him with tremendous force that only when his life could really be regarded as the exemplification of holiness to the Lord would he attain this closeness to God. He had to be spiritually what the priest had to be physically as a condition of office. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto Aaron, saying, Whosoever he be of thy seed in their generations that hath any blemish, let him not approach to offer the bread of his God. The ministry of such a man would defile the court, holy place, and most holy place alike. He shall not go in unto the veil, nor come nigh unto the altar, because he hath a blemish, that he profane not my sanctuaries. For I, the Lord, do sanctify them. This carnal ordinance clearly taught that God, the Holy One, could not endure the near presence of a morally defective or deformed man. Once more, therefore, the law demanded of the pious Israelite nothing more nor less than spiritual perfection. That alone could enable him to stand in the divine presence. Only when his life was the morally fruitful counterpart of the pomegranates on the high priest's robe could it sound forth as a peal of bells announcing him to be in the holy before the Lord. God in man. We've just seen how Aaron stood for his fellow men in their ideal condition as a dynasty of priests. In passing, we note also that his representative character had its Godward as well as its manward aspect. This too was stressed in the symbolism of the law. The physical perfection which qualified him symbolically to act as the perfect exemplar of his brethren qualified him also to stand in the same relation to them as God to man. He, in fact, represented God in the midst of Israel. This again was effected by a variety of devices, some of which we can quickly scan at this stage. The firstborn were all God's. Mine shall they be. I am the Lord. How significant, in the light of that fact, was the law given to Aaron. Everything that openeth the matrix in all flesh which they bring unto the Lord, whether it be of men or beasts, shall be thine. In other words, the Israelite who brought his firstborn to Aaron and was thus in symbol acknowledging his duty to dedicate both himself and his possessions to God was to see in Aaron a type of God to whom the firstborn rightly belonged. Aaron then was the human representative of God par excellence, and so, though to a lesser degree, were his sons. The type held good in many ways. The priest had power to bless the people with the assurance that the blessing would materialize. They shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. Likewise, with the same finality as that with which God had chosen Israel and made a difference between them and the heathen, so the priests had authority to pronounce the suspect leper either clean or unclean, with all that that action involved symbolically. It was they too who, through the blowing of trumpets, called the people to assemble or strike camp. In such cases, the trumpet blast was a type of the voice of God calling to his people and the trumpeters of him who called. As the priest could symbolize both the people and God himself, so the trumpet blasts could symbolize both the voice of Israel and the voice of God, according to the circumstances. In all this, by extension, the discerning Israelite should have seen also an adumbration of Israel's priestly role among the nations, possessing within it the secret of the blessing which God intended for all families of the earth in Abraham's seed. The priest then stood for God as well as man, for Yahweh as well as Israel. Aaron, being the epitome of the priestly people, was thus a parallel type to the sanctuary in which he ministered. Both it and he were dwelling places for God. The Urim and Thummim meant that his word was the authentic counsel of God, that he was God's spokesman. God himself, as it were, speaking to those who sought judgment. Gazing therefore upon Aaron as he ministered thus in his official capacity, the discerning Israelite saw himself, since Aaron was his ideal self, as one intended to be in fact what Aaron was in symbol: God manifest in the flesh. The thought was truly staggering, almost fantastic, but it was in perfect conformity with the divine intention in the creation of man. This was the purpose of human life for all men, Gentiles as much as Israelites. The type in this case merely taught, like so many others, that Israel, as God's firstborn, was offered the privilege first of realizing the destiny of man and of nations in terms of concrete holiness of life. God's rule has always been to the Jew first, but its corollary has always been, and also to the Gentile. The ministry in the sanctuary. As we have seen, the priesthood and the sanctuary were parallel types, each laying the same urgent demands upon Israel. Both of them, God and man, symbolically met together. Each was a fusion, as it were, of the divine and the human. And this was beautifully symbolized by the colors, amongst other devices. Blue, typified God in heaven. Scarlet, the sin-stricken life of man coursing through his blood. Betwixt the two, allowing them to be juxtaposed without offence to the eye, fusing them harmoniously together because it stood in the closest relationship to both, was purple. The means by which God and man would be reconciled. That was the great theme of the sanctuary. Here we note that 3 was also the number of divisions in the sanctuary, and again the number of metals used in its construction. We can be sure that the parallels cannot be accidental, but is part of the divine design which appointed to everything its form and purpose. We will deal first with the threefold division of the sanctuary. It is clear that the term sanctuary connoted more than the board building draped over with curtains and skins, which is known familiarly as the tabernacle. That is implicit in the fact that the woman recently delivered of child was excluded from the sanctuary until the days of her purification be fulfilled. And the high priest, when bereaved, was not to go out of the sanctuary nor profane it by entering it when he was accidentally defiled. Clearly, the sanctuary in each case comprehended the court and had 3 divisions in all: the court, the holy place, and the most holy place. On the Day of Atonement, each of these was atoned for in turn, beginning with the most holy place. Each of these divisions, as we have seen already, was properly the sphere of ministry of the Levite, the priests, and the high priest, respectively. Now, since all 3 classes of minister equally represented the entire nation, so also must these 3 divisions of the sanctuary, with which their service was particularly associated. This means that the sanctuary also had a pyramid-shaped symbolic pattern, with the court for base and the most holy place forming the apex. As the conclusion already reached with regard to that pattern would lead us to expect, we find once again that as we proceed from base to apex, from the outer confines of the sanctuary to its heart, so the moral lesson common to each of its parts is presented in a more heightened and more intensive form. The basic requirement of the symbolism of the sanctuary was righteousness. That was unequivocally intimated by the fact that the sanctuary was separated from the world around by a screen of fine twined linen. All about were the dark tents of Israel. Against them the white screen stood out in significant contrast, the very emblem of moral spotlessness. In so far as the court represented the people busy in God's service, the screen was therefore a challenge to them to be spotlessly white in character and conduct, to fit them for the stupendous responsibility of having God in their midst. It's in keeping with this fact that the court was sometimes called the holy place. Admission to the court was through the gate. For the gate of the court shall be an hanging of 20 cubits of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twined linen wrought with needlework, and their pillars shall be 4 and their sockets 4. The Israelite who wished to offer a sacrifice upon the altar could not enter the court except through the divinely appointed entrance, and on the terms which it stipulated as the conditions of access to God. The colours told him that on the basis of righteousness, the fine twined linen, expressing itself in good works, the needlework, he and God could be at one, but on no other basis. Entering, he found the first object facing him astride his direct access to the tabernacle to be the altar. It stood, as did the altar at Horeb, for God, since whatsoever toucheth the altar shall be holy. There I will meet with the children of Israel, and the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my glory, said God. The Levite, the type of the ordinary Israelite, was therefore forbidden access to it. I will sanctify the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar. I will sanctify also both Aaron and his sons to minister to me in the priest's office. Yet, so holy was the altar that even the priests could not approach it, nor enter the tabernacle proper, without the ritual confession that access to it demanded sinlessness in those who sought it. This was arranged by provision of the laver, which comprised a large bowl set on a pedestal trough. Thou shalt also make a laver of brass, and his foot also of brass, to wash withal. And thou shalt put it between the tabernacle of the congregation and the altar. And thou shalt put water therein, for Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet thereat, when they go into the tabernacle of the congregation. They shall wash with water, that they die not. Or when they come near to the altar to minister, to burn offering made by fire unto the Lord, so shall they wash their hands and their feet, that they die not. And it shall be a statute forever to them, even to him and to his seed throughout their generations. The contact with God necessitated perfect holiness in act and walk. That rule was to hold good for all time. Yet the altar was the symbol of more than God's presence. It was his table as well. The flesh and fat and meal consumed upon it were his bread and his food. Upon it Israel, through their priestly representatives, were commanded to offer a daily offering of bread. That is, in symbol, to offer daily the worship which gave satisfaction to God. Now this is that which thou shalt offer upon the altar: two lambs of the first year, day by day continually. The one lamb shalt thou offer in the morning, and the other lamb thou shalt offer at even. And with the one lamb, a tenth deal of flour mingled with the fourth part of an hin of beaten oil, and the fourth part of an hin of wine for a drink offering. And the other lamb thou shalt offer at even, and shalt do thereto according to the meat offering of the morning, and according to the drink offering thereof, for a sweet savour, an offering made by fire unto the Lord. This shall be a continual burnt offering throughout your generations at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord, where I will meet you to speak there unto thee. anticipating later study, we can here state summarily that lambs of burnt offering symbolize the total dedication to God of Israel's life and powers, and the meat and drink offering the total dedication to him of the fruits of their labors. What was significant was that this had to be done twice daily, that is, morning and evening. Israel were to renew their vows of total dedication to God. As each day began, so the nation in the aggregate, and by implication every individual Israel as well, pledged themselves afresh to serve God with entirety. And as each day ended, so the Israelite lay down to sleep with the same resolve in his heart with regard to the morrow. To emphasize this great lesson for the guidance of Israel's life, an additional law was promulgated for the priests. They also had to offer a daily meat offering on their own behalf, half in the morning, half in the evening. This again stressed in the most emphatic form what was the duty of the priestly people. Their entire offering had to be wholly burnt. For every meat offering for the priest shall be wholly burnt. That is, the priestly people was to consecrate itself wholly to God. It shall not be eaten. Nothing pertaining to the priestly people was to be withheld from God. Like the fire upon the altar, its service was to be constant. The fire shall ever be burning upon the altar. It shall never go out. And that undying flame was a continual reminder of the fact that only by atoning sacrifice was Israel able to enjoy its intercourse with God.